And welcome back to Coast. Here's Robert Zubrin now for a couple hours, inventor of several unique concepts for space propulsion and exploration. You know him. He's been on before. He founded the Mars Society, which is an international organization dedicated to furthering the exploration and settlement of Mars by public and private means. He's also come up with EnergyVictory.net. We'll talk about both of them tonight on Coast to Coast. Robert, welcome back, my friend. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good, good. Where do you want to head? Mars Society or Energy First? What's on your agenda?
Well, let's start, say, with energy.
Energy it is. Where are we these days? After the BP spill, they're still going to drill for oil. What's going to go on? What's happening?
Well, George, I think we're in trouble. Because you have oil right now is at $80 a barrel, when contrary to the government statement, the economy is in recession. And not just the U.S. economy, but the world economy.
That's right.
And if oil can be at $80 a barrel under conditions where you have 10% unemployment in the United States officially and maybe 17% in reality, and worse conditions in Europe and even worse in Japan, it means that the price of oil is set to skyrocket to over $150, probably over $200 a barrel as soon as the economy begins to recover. And if that happens, basically, we're giving away the store. During 2008, when the price of oil briefly went to $140 a barrel, 10% of the value of the entire U.S. Fortune 500 was transferred from New York to Riyadh.
Absolutely. And I'm not sure, Robert, the automobile industry can sustain another hit.
Good point. It might not. But, you know, it wasn't just the automobile industry that took the hit from that $1 trillion that Americans paid for oil in 2008. Because, see, people connect the failure of the auto industry to the oil price. But what they don't realize is the housing market also collapsed for the exact same reason. That is, you can spend your money on oil or you can spend it on houses. You can't
spend it
on both.
You can't do
and it sunk the whole economy. And what we're being set up for is we start to recover. The price of oil will spike to $200 a barrel, and then we'll be sent right back into recession again, except we'll be a lot poorer than we were before. And then the next time, it'll happen again and again. We need to create a competitive market in fuel, which does not exist right now.
In your book, Energy Victory, Winning the War on Terror by Breaking Free of Oil, what do you recommend that we do? How do we break free?
The way we break free is by curing our cars of their oil addiction. You know, these people, they say, oh, we're addicted to oil. Well, that's just nonsense. We're not addicted to oil. It's our cars that are addicted to oil. Our cars are kind of like people that can only eat one kind of food, you know, like herring or something. And so if the herring merchants want to charge $100 a pound for herring, they still have to pay. You're much better off being a normal person who can eat steak, ice cream, cantaloupe, sweet potatoes, bread, corn, whatever. Okay. That's our problem. The cars are stuck on oil. Now, the technology exists today to make cars that can run equally well on gasoline, ethanol, or methanol. These are called flex fuel cars. Yeah. And methanol is really the key here because methanol is currently selling internationally for $1 a gallon without any subsidy. It can be made as cheaply as 50 cents a gallon.
Oh, my gosh.
It can be made from coal. It can be made from natural gas. It can be made from any kind of biomass at all, not just food grains, but crop residues, forestry residues. It can be made from recycled urban trash, old candy wrappers.
What percent would you run your car on that? 100%, 20%? What would you do?
Well, the flex fuel car can use any percent. That is, flex fuel car. It's exactly that. It's flexible. It's just like, you know, you or I today, we could eat one kind of food, and another day we could eat a different mixture of foods, and it wouldn't matter. The same with the flex fuel car. So you could fill it up on methanol in the morning, and you're driving out, and the car is almost empty, and you're out somewhere, and the only gas station you see is one that sells unleaded, so you fill up on that. And then you drive around, and maybe you come to a station that's selling ethanol. You could fill up on that. And, of course, if there was, part gasoline left in your tank, then what you'd be burning would be part ethanol and part methanol and part gasoline. And the car would just run just fine.
You're getting pretty good mileage to that, too?
Well, it depends. It is true that gasoline, you get more miles per gallon with gasoline. But the real question that most people want to know is how many miles per dollar do they get?
Right.
And depending upon the price, the methanol can be significantly cheaper than gasoline. Especially, okay, it's a little cheaper right now. It'll be much cheaper if the oil price spikes. And that's the key, okay? That is, the issue is not so much getting gasoline below $2 a gallon as it is stopping it from going to $6 a gallon, okay, which it can do. We went above $5 in 2008 in many places, and we can go back there and well beyond there unless there's competition. That's the thing. If the cars have fuel choice, then they can't raise the price of oil beyond a certain amount.
That's a good point.
And that's what we mean.
Is it going to take another crisis, Robert, for people to react to this?
Well, I don't know. It's a question of waking the Congress up. You know, there's a bill, the Open Fuel Standards Act. That's what it's called. It's in the House. It's in the Senate. It's about 10 congressmen and 10 senators in each one, and there's both Republicans and Democrats that support this bill. But, you know, Harry Reid would not include it in his energy bill. He just wouldn't include it. And they're pushing all kinds of silly stuff that won't do any good at all. They're pushing subsidies for electric cars that nobody wants because it takes them 8 hours to recharge. And you know who invented the electric car?
Probably the electric companies.
Well, Thomas Edison.
Yeah.
Actually, fine invention. It's great. It's been around for 110 years, and it's never been a success, except for, you know, things like golf carts and factory forklifts and, you know, some special applications.
Things like that, yeah.
Because it just is not a match for a car that runs on liquid fuel that in the course of a minute you can fuel up to run all day at 60 miles an hour. And it's not the answer. For cars, the right answer is liquid fuel. That's why the gasoline car has been triumphant. But the problem is that the cars are rigged right now to only run on a fuel that is in the control of our enemies.
What will it take to change that, to re-rig it?
Well, I hope that people listening to this show contact their congressmen and senators and say, we want you to pass the Open Fuel Standards Act because we don't want to be ripped off by OPEC again and again and again and again. You know, the U.S. Energy policy has been the most remarkable fail. I mean, of all the departments in the United States government, the worst is the Department of Energy. That is, you know, I have problems with NASA, as we'll discuss. You know,
sure.
Lots of things they do that I don't agree with. They screw up on this. They screw up on that. But NASA has succeeded in certain things. You know, they landed men on the moon. They landed rovers on Mars. They have a probe orbiting Saturn.
They have had goals.
They've had a list of achievements. And one could say they should have accomplished more, but they have accomplished some things. The Department of Energy, I can't think of anything they've accomplished. I mean, literally anything. They were founded to make us independent of foreign oil. And when they were founded, this country was 35% dependent on foreign oil. Today, it's 65% dependent on foreign oil. Not only have they accomplished nothing, the things that they were, problems they were supposed to cure have gotten worse and worse and worse. Okay, and right now Secretary Chu is running around throwing money in all directions on various exotic research programs that have nothing to do with anything. You know, they're trying to use energy policy to try to change the weather. Well, you know, they're not going to change the weather. Their job should be to make sure that Americans have liquid fuel at affordable price, not to whatever they're doing. Who knows?
Okay. In terms of infrastructure, Robert, to get these pumps, these ethanol and methanol exclusive stations, they could go up pretty quickly, couldn't they?
Oh, sure. See, here's the thing. What this open fuel standard bill would do is it would pass a law saying that all new cars sold in the U.S. would have to be flex fueled. Every new car has to give the consumer fuel choice.
From a certain date, right?
So yeah, from the date that it's passed.
All right.
And the, or the next year, or whatever.
Or whatever. Okay? There's going to be at some time, grandfather time, no doubt.
Exactly. Now, so within 3 years of enactment, you'd have 30 million cars on the road in the United States capable of running on alternative fuels. Under those conditions, gas station owners would start installing the pumps. Right now, there's no reason for them to install a methanol pump because there's hardly any cars that could use it. Okay? No one's going to buy it. But as soon as these cars are around in significant numbers, okay, then you'll start seeing methanol and ethanol pumps at every corner gas station. And here's the real key. Not just in the United States, but all over the world. Because if we make it the law that to sell a car here, it's got to give people fuel choice, all the foreign car makers will switch their lines over to conform to this requirement. And so Japanese cars, not only sold in the U.S., but sold in Japan and in India and Africa, would all be flex-fueled. And same with European cars sold worldwide, as well as, of course, American cars. So that every car being sold in any serious way worldwide would be flex-fuel. There would be methanol pumps and ethanol pumps going up, not just in Iowa, but in Argentina, in India, in Kenya, France, Poland, everywhere. Gasoline would be forced to compete at the pump against both ethanol and methanol made from any number of possible sources. Maybe there'll be ethanol made from corn in Iowa, but it'll be methanol made from coal in Poland and, you know, made from rotten fruit in Ecuador. You know, it doesn't matter, okay? The point is that every country in the world has some way or other it can make one or other of these alternate fuels, and that will subject gasoline to competition. If they try to raise the price of gasoline to $6 a gallon, well, people will just buy methanol, and that way they won't, okay? They won't. You know, in 2008, when the price of gas spiked above $5 a gallon here, it didn't go up at all in Brazil, not a penny. It couldn't. Because in Brazil, the majority of cars are flex-fuel cars, and they have ethanol pumps at practically every gas station.
What about trucks, the big trucks? Could they be converted to, or are they still going to stay on diesel?
Well, trucks in general are diesel, and diesel-powered trucks would not be converted because diesel is a different kind of engine. But the thing is, the smaller trucks, many of which are gasoline, they would be converted. But the thing is, what we would really do here is we would pin down the price of oil. We'd fence it in. And so actually, even people who didn't have flex fuel cars, people who still had older gasoline-only cars, they'd all benefit from this because the price of gas would not be able to go up.
All right.
And
Robert,
that's the thing. So anyway, this is what we need. Nothing else is going to work. You can't beat OPEC with conservation, okay? A guy riding past a gas station on a bicycle doesn't compel the gasoline station to lower the price of gas. A gas station across the street selling methanol at $1 a gallon, that compels the gas station to lower its price.
Absolutely. This sounds like a doable plan, doesn't it?
It's entirely doable. It's just a question of getting the Congress to act intelligent, which, okay, maybe that's not too, it's amazing. I mean,
that could be an oxymoron right there, huh?
Yeah. Do you know what they did this past year, that in the health care bill, they stuck in the middle of the healthcare bill, in the middle of 2,500 pages of small type, they stuck in a provision changing the tax code to make every business, big corporations, small businesses, you know, I own a small business, I employ 15 people at Pioneer Astronautics, and even sole proprietorships, okay, people who aren't even incorporated, each one of them under this new law is going to have to report on a separate 1099 every purchase they make of $600 or more. And this applies, by the way, not just to single items that cost $600, like, say, a computer. But if you go to the hardware store and you get a bunch of parts over the course of a year that add up to over $600, you'll have to report that.
Wait, who do you 1099? The hardware store?
That's right. That's right. Okay. This is they stuck this in the healthcare bill, believe it or not. Okay. A change to U.S. tax law. So a company like mine, I'm going to need to get like 300 or 400 1099s. Okay, a company like Lockheed Martin.
Yeah, every supplier or everything you buy, which in most cases will be over $600, you're going to have to 1099 this.
Right.
At the end of the year.
Yeah, but now look at this from the point of view of the hardware store. They've got 10,000 customers, perhaps. Okay, and they're going to have to keep records of the purchases of each one of them separately, so they can fill out the form accurately at the end of the year and know that this customer spent $837.89 and this other one spent, you know, $1,142.24.
Unbelievable.
And they're going to have to send this out. So, you know, they're saying that they're doing this to raise money. They're not going to raise money, okay? They're going to force many small businesses out of business. The other businesses like mine I'm going to have to hire a person at $50,000 a year just to keep track of all these forms for me. So the government will lose $12,000. That is, because that money will come right off my bottom line.
Right.
The same thing, the hardware store, they'll have to hire a platoon of people to keep track of this for them. And that will lower their bottom line and also cause the price of hardware to go up. And major corporations will have to have millions of these forms. And then here's something else, okay? It applies to sole proprietors, people who aren't even incorporated. Now, there's no fundamental difference between a sole proprietor and any private
business. Well, why are they doing this? I mean, I can understand 1099-ing a worker who makes a certain amount of money, and he's not a staff member. I can understand that. But why 1099 everything over $600?
It's for control. They say it's for money, that they want to raise more taxes to pay for the health care bill. But this isn't even going to raise any money. This is going to reduce the IRS's money. It's going to throw millions of people out of work when businesses fold under the pressure of this. It'll make all kinds of things cost more because companies' overheads are going to increase. It will lower tax revenues because there'll be fewer businesses in business, and those that are in business will make less money. This is crazy. And Harry Reid stuck this in. This thing was passed through fraud. Okay, no one knew it was in the bill. Okay,
That's because they didn't read it, right?
Well, who read it? No one could have read their bill. That's why they made it so long, so that no one could read it. They also stuck into all kinds of other crazy stuff. They have laws about gold buying and selling in the healthcare bill, and so forth. People are making discoveries every week on what they stuck in the healthcare. Who knows what's in the healthcare bill? Okay, for all anyone knows, there are death panels in the healthcare bill because no one's read it. I mean, anyway, the point is, okay, this thing was stuck through by fraud, but then 2 weeks ago, there was an attempt in the Senate to pass a separate bill that would repeal this provision because
Anybody needs information on that, energyvictory.net on that. Robert, we're at the break. We're going to come back and talk about Mars and NASA and your elevator on Coast to Coast AM. Well, it's not too early to start thinking about some holiday Christmas presents, and one of them is the After Dark magazine. How about that for a stocking stuffer? Just call 1-888-261-6392 if you don't have a computer. 1-888-261-6392, or go online at coasttocoastam.com and subscribe to the After Dark magazine. Robert, let's talk a little bit about your space elevator. You were talking with me about that several months ago. Can you explain that concept again?
Okay, well, I call it a space, a transorbital railroad.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and actually, it's not a new technology. It's a new way of doing business. What I'm proposing is this, that the U.S. government decides to buy launch services as follows, that it could start it this way, that six times a year, it's going to buy a heavy lift vehicle from sold to it by private launch.
Private launch, okay.
And six times a year, medium lift vehicle. So it has a launch every other every month. Every other month, heavy lift. Every other month, medium lift. And these things go off on schedule, okay? Whether they're filled with payload or not, just like a train.
It's going.
It's going, okay? The it's just launching them once a month. It goes. And, okay, it makes available space on these rockets at heavily subsidized price. That's, for example, a heavy lift vehicle maybe costs $500 million, okay, a launch. That's a high estimate, but we'll take it, all right? This is 100 tons to low Earth orbit class vehicle. Medium lift vehicle, say $70 million a launch for 20 tons to orbit. So the total cost of this program, the six heavy lift vehicles at 500 each, that's $3 billion, plus another six at 70 billion each, another $400 million. So it's $3.4 billion, which is less than the cost of the shuttle program. But what you're launching to orbit every year is a capacity of 700 tons to orbit.
That's a lot, right?
Yeah. Now, here's the thing. You would make available on the 100 ton to LEO vehicle, if someone wanted to buy the full 100 tons, $10 million. If they want to buy just 10 tons of capacity, $1 million.
So you're selling capacity.
Yes, but you're selling it at a very low rate. In other words, this operation is not intended to make money in itself. Okay?
Could somebody buy it and then parcel it out and try to make money doing that?
Well, no, that's not the idea. The idea here is to make it cheap and easy for anyone to get to space. Okay? That is, the government is providing a service here. It's like building a harbor, okay, or an airport. It's making possible, or a transcontinental railroad. It's putting in an investment on behalf of the nation. Now, the idea, let me just explain again. So you have this 100-ton to LEO vehicle. Okay, which cost the government $500 million.
All right.
Okay. But it sells the space. And the only reason why it's selling the space instead of giving it away is to make sure that people aren't just taking up space for the hell of it, okay, that people have a reason. Okay. It's making available space almost for free. Okay. That is, it'll provide the whole vehicle for $10 million or a tenth of it, 10-ton capacity for $1 million. Or 1-ton capacity for 100,000, or 100-kilogram capacity, that's 220 pounds, for $10,000.
All right.
So that the so basically, even an individual with $10,000 could get to space or put a small payload on board, and a business willing to spend $100,000 could get a whole ton of capacity.
Well, okay. All right, but what are they taking up there, though?
Right? So the idea here, then, is what you're doing is it's making possible for anyone. Now, this would include government agencies. That is, if the Jet Propulsion Lab wants to send a probe to Mars or Saturn, they could buy space on one of these, and their launch would be almost free, okay, the Defense Department. But also, let's say a private society, like the Mars Society, wanted to launch a space probe, or even at some point, if it could raise enough money, to build a colony on Mars. The transportation would be there. If NASA wanted to build a moon base, they wouldn't have to figure out how to design a new launch vehicle. They would just say, oh, well, we'll need to use three of those launches each year, okay, or half of them, and the and so forth. But private corporations, the idea is that this would make possible every vision and every dream. Okay, I, for example, am not a particularly a believer in this idea of solar power satellites. I don't think they could be competitive with Earth-based power generation. But there are some people who do think that that could work. Well, they would have a chance to give their business plan a try. The people who believe in space hotels would have a chance to give their business plan a try. The people who, you know, whether government activity, corporate activity, private individuals, they'd all have a way to get to space. Now, this would cost some money, but it would only, I mean, in other words, to do this, okay, we're shutting down the space shuttle program. Space shuttle program in its best year launched 120 tons to orbit. This last year launched more like 40 tons to orbit. Instead, with less money than that, we can launch 700 tons to orbit and open up space enterprise to everyone.
And we could do it relatively soon, too.
Yeah, we could do it straight away. And this would foster the private launch industry because they'd be selling these launches, okay? Now, and since they would know they would have a reliable market, okay, they could then start doing mass production. And then the price of the launch to the government would start coming down, and which would mean that for the same budget, this is how I would prefer to do it, we would have more launches. So instead of a once-a-month launch, we could have twice-a-month launch or once-a-week launch. Okay, and we could really do this because unlike the shuttle, which they could never launch once a week because each shuttle, when it comes down, has to be practically rebuilt, these are expendable launch vehicles that would just be rolling off the assembly line, you know, and just firing them off. And so we really could have a high-frequency launch rate.
Now, would the big ones be Saturn style in terms of size?
Yes, that's what a heavy lift launcher is. Saturn V could do 140 tons. So it could be something like that or something like the Ares V that NASA was designing for the Constellation Moon program until Obama canceled it.
Which was canceled.
The Senate just passed, the House and the Senate just passed a bill that would provide the beginnings of funding for a low-end heavy lift vehicle, 75 tons. To orbit kind of thing, that's only half the capability of a Saturn V. But even so, you could base your orbital railroad on such vehicles if you wanted to. And once again, the cost of rockets is so large because they're built in ones and twos. You know, you take even a well-proven, been used hundreds of time rocket engine, the RL-10, okay, is one very well, it's a workhorse.
Very reliable.
Okay, yeah. Workhorse rocket engine. It weighs 500 pounds, which is less metal than is contained in a small car, significantly less. It's less complex than a small car. Yet, a small car can be bought for $10,000 or $20,000, and RL-10 will cost you $3 million. Okay? This is the difference between things that are made, you know, two or three a year and things that are made, you know, $2 or $3 million a year.
So are you saying mass produce these things?
Well, yes.
Almost?
It would be obviously not mass produced in the sense that we mass produce cars, but mass produced in the sense that, for instance, during World War II, we mass produced Liberty ships.
Yeah.
Okay. And so they become cheaper. And we can launch more and more of them. And now here's the thing. Let's say the Europeans look at this and they say, this is unfair. The U.S. government is subsidizing its launch industry.
So what?
Well, my answer is, fine, you could do the same thing.
Exactly.
Europe, you build your transorbital railroad. Go ahead. Make it easy for Europeans to get to orbit, same way as we're doing here. And Russians, you're welcome to do it, too.
Is there any reason why the Europeans wouldn't contract with a company here and buy payload space?
Well, they might. Depending upon what the particular rules the railroad was set up, it might give preference to Americans since it was being funded by American taxpayers.
Right.
But my answer, once again, is let's have two transorbital railroads. Let's, instead of 700 tons a year going to space, let's have 1,400 tons. Okay? And so forth. The more the merrier. In other words, if we did this, and if the Europeans did it, I hope they do. And if the Russians were to do it, I hope they do. Now we got over 2,000 tons a year going to orbit. And then the price of the launch vehicles start coming down because since the launch companies will know that they have a guaranteed market, they can just start rolling these things off their assembly line, so to speak. And pretty soon, instead of 2,000 tons to orbit, we'll have 4,000, we'll have 10,000 tons going to orbit every year.
Someone's going to do it first, Robert, aren't they?
Yeah, well, there's nothing in this that we can't do, that we could do this straight away. And the thing is, you see, I started thinking about this because, you know, I've been trying to get the U.S. government to embrace the idea of humans to Mars. And I still think they should very much. Okay, I think NASA should have a goal and that should be it. But it's so hard to get these guys to focus and to say, look, if you want to go to Mars, let's do it with the fewest possible diversions. Instead, what they do is they sit down and say, gee, we want to go to Mars someday. What are all the things we might want to do before we do that, which is a way to never get there? If we did this, if we took this step, what this would do would, first of all, it would simplify for those people in NASA who do want to go to Mars. They could say, okay, well, we know how to at least get the things up to orbit. We'll just book three flights on the orbital railroad, okay?
Yeah.
You know, just like if you want to go to Paris, you don't have to figure out how to design the airplane. You just buy the ticket. But furthermore, it would allow all sorts of other people to launch bold space ventures. It would allow privately funded Mars missions to occur because instead of having to design the whole thing, they would just have to design and build their payloads, whether those are robotic payloads or human payloads. So everything would become much easier. This is the concept of the transorbital railroad. And it's a way to just break free of this whole problem that we've had of no one can get to orbit except at ridiculously high prices.
Let's talk for a moment about your efforts through the Mars Society to terraform Mars. A great program, should have been done 15 years ago, Robert. Hasn't been done yet. Are we ever going to even try?
Well, terraforming Mars is for the future. I think what you meant to say was to send human explorers to Mars.
Well, eventually. I mean, yes, before that. But don't you think we should be attempting to terraform Mars now? It's a 100-year project?
Well, yeah. To terraform Mars, once we're established on Mars, could be a 100-year project. The immediate task, of course, for our age, you know, for you and me and the people who are working in the space industry and for the people who support it and the public today, is to get our first outpost established on Mars.
Right.
Plant that first seed. You know, really, okay, there's two ways this could be done, either publicly or privately. If it's done publicly, okay, that's NASA's job. And right now, that's the only option we have at the moment. And I think as long as we have a space agency, it should do its job, which is to explore space. And really, the thing on the agenda, the challenge that has been staring NASA in the face since the end of the Apollo program in the early 1970s, has been sending humans to Mars. And it's really a question of embracing that challenge and saying, this is the task. How do I do it? Let's do it. Okay, instead of, this is a task, what other tasks might I say I should do before I do that so I never have to face that challenge? Okay.
And it's a three-year program to send somebody, isn't it?
The actual flight is a 2.5-year round trip. That is, it takes 6 months to get to Mars, then you're there for a year and a half, then it's 6 months to fly back to Earth.
What human being could handle that, Robert, mentally? What do you think?
Oh, any. I mean, you know, I mean, during World War II, my dad was away for 3 years under much worse conditions than...
But he wasn't locked up in a spacecraft for 6 months.
Locked up in a spacecraft for 6 months? A lot of people have been locked up in jails for a lot longer than that. and very ordinary people have survived it. I mean, here, you know, Anne Frank and her family were in an attic for 2.5 years. And the, you know, and those were just people who faced that by circumstance. They were not picked people chosen for their...
Well, I guess if they were picked and they were, you know, trained for this, they might be able to handle it. I'm not sure I could for 6 months.
Well, let me put it to you this way, George. Let me offer you a deal, because I can't actually deliver on this deal. But let's say someone offered you this deal.
All right, take it. What is it?
Okay, here's the deal, George. Someone comes up to you and says, if you're willing just to stay inside your house for 6 months, like you're under house arrest, and do nothing but sit around the house, watch TV, read books, do crossword puzzle, I'll give you $1 million.
For 6 straight months?
Yeah, 6 months. You're confined to your house for 6 months. You can watch TV. You can listen to music. You know, you can play chess by mail over the internet. You just sit around, you know, get up, drink coffee, have a newspaper, hang around the house, can't go outside for 6 months, and in return you get $1 million. I think there'd be a lot of takers for that deal.
Well, but if you said stay in your bathroom for 6 months, I'm not sure I would take that deal.
Well, but the spacecraft's not a bathroom.
Well, but it's not that much bigger, is it?
No, it's bigger. It's bigger. The Habitat spacecraft that we designed for Mars Direct is 1,000 square feet. So
like like an apartment.
Yeah, it's like an apartment. It's like a large one bedroom or a small two bedroom apartment.
With New York rent rates.
Well, no, except now think about this. You're flying to Mars, man. Okay, unlike Anne Frank and her family who are hiding in an attic with Nazis running around on the outside with listening devices, being terrorized all the time.
Petrified.
Okay, here you are. You're going to Mars. You know you're a hero to the entire world. You have all that moral support behind you.
You probably got a book deal the minute you're back.
Right? Yeah, well, you got more than book. You got advertising endorsements. You know, your fortune's made. You're going to be invited on the board of various corporations and be given, you know, $100 million stock option plans. And all. So this is not that hard a deal. This is a lot easier than a GI in World War II who is being taken away to fight in, you know, the Philippines or something and put up with not only Japanese, but malaria and idiotic officers, you know, 90-day wonders and army food and all of this and a pretty good chance of getting killed. And when you do, you'll, you know, what they had it a lot tougher. And
there's no doubt they did, Robert. Look, we're at the top of the hour already, fast hour. We're going to take phone calls with you when we come back, and we'll wrap up this end of the conversation when we come back.